Good afternoon, Your Honors. If it may please the court, my name is Jan Zavisla, and I'm a Deputy Attorney General. I'm joined at council table by Senior Assistant Attorney General Paul Chesson. We represent both the state and the administrator of the Uniform Consumer Credit Code, both of whom were applicants in the original contempt citation that this lengthy case is still part of. When we were before a different panel of the Court of Appeals almost 6 years ago today, the vast majority of the questions from that panel concerned whether or not this was a case of mistaken identity. Were the internet payday lenders cash advance and preferred cash loans trade names utilized by two Nevada corporations that the state had identified and had issued subpoenas to and the contempt citations had been issued to? Were they trade names of two subordinate economic corporations of a tribe out of Oklahoma and a tribe out of Nebraska, whom the state had never heard of, to whom the state had never issued a subpoena or a contempt citation? Or was it simply a coincidence, as the tribal entities argued back then, that the Nevada corporations and these tribal entities both happened to be using the exact same trade names to engage in the exact same business? We've learned a lot in 6 years since we've been to the Supreme Court and back on remand. Not all the questions are answered, but the trial court made some findings that I think are instructive in this case.
Pardon me for interrupting, no, Mr. Savislin, but before you get going, do we have jurisdiction over this appeal?
I'm sorry.
Do we have jurisdiction over this appeal?
I believe you most certainly do, Your Honor.
Would you please address the question whether or not the notice of appeal was late in this case?
Certainly. The issue for the state of Colorado is one of finality, right? When a case is final, it means that all issues as to all parties have been resolved. In this case, and I understand that the history and the record of this case is complicated and doesn't sometimes make a lot of sense, but understand that the contempt citation procedure, of which this is still part, was brought against two Nevada corporations, CB Service Corporation, Executive Global Management. The tribal entities interposed themselves into that proceeding, even though they had never been served, and they jointly battled side by side with those two Nevada corporations on motions to dismiss that were resolved initially by the court in March of 2007. The contempt procedure against all four of those entities, as well as against Mr. Fontano, another contemnor at the time, processed through the normal course. The tribal entities appealed, the Nevada corporations did not. In February of 2012, Judge Hoffman resolved the issues with respect to the tribal entities' motion to dismiss, but did not resolve and did not have anything currently before him with respect to the Nevada corporations. Now, we've been through this road twice before with Mr. Hicks, having a determination by the Court of Appeals that because there were still parties and issues unresolved, that appeal wasn't final. So we took the step, without opposition from the tribal entities, to seek voluntary dismissal with prejudice of the two Nevada corporations so that there would be no question whatsoever that finally, in this protracted litigation, all issues with regard to all parties had been resolved, and our appeal was timely from the grant of that motion to dismiss them with prejudice.
What was the status of the last two contempt citations after Judge Hoffman's February 2012 order?
They were still pending, Your Honor.
Could contempt have been imposed?
I think that the state had a couple of options at that point because they were still viable parties in the case. Admittedly, they'd been absent for a while, but they were still viable parties in the case. That the state could have proceeded to continue to try to compel their appearance in this litigation. And remember, it was the corporation's non-appearance in March of 2007, which led to the non-appearance warrant that issued to Mr. Hicks, which is part of this appeal, the state could have continued to pursue those issues. It could have continued to pursue production of records from those two corporations through other contempt remedies that were available to the state. The fact is that contempt issues with regard to them had not been fully resolved.
What order of the court were you alleging they were in contempt of?
February of 2005, Your Honor, the state obtained an order enforcing two different subpoenas, one against preferred cash loans, one against cash advance. When that order enforcing subpoenas was ignored, the state went back to the trial court in June of 2005 and requested and obtained citations to both of those two entities. We have now identified them as being two Nevada corporations, to appear and show cause why they should not be held in contempt.
Wasn't that order vacated by Judge Hoffman's order?
It was not. Only, what makes this so complicated.
Not the contempt order, but wasn't the order to issue the subpoena vacated by Judge Hoffman's order?
Not with respect to those two Nevada corporations. Again, you have to understand that what makes this case so convoluted is subpoenas were never issued to these tribal entities. The state never sought document one from them. Contempt citations weren't issued to these entities. The state didn't seek contempt against them. We subpoenaed and got an enforcement order and a contempt citation against two Nevada corporations. Tribal entities appeared on their own, as we alleged for years now, to run interference for the owner and the operator of these payday lending operations. So the resolution of the contempt citation with respect to those two entities had no bearing whatsoever on the contempt citations that remained outstanding with respect to the two Nevada corporations.
Well, the Judge Hoffman's order says in part, quote, the orders enforcing the administrative subpoenas are vacated, unquote. Once he says that, how could you hold anybody in contempt based on non-compliance with the administrative subpoenas?
The only parties that were before him, the only subpoenas or contempt citations that were before him in that order, and I assume you're referring to his amended order of February 18th, were the two tribal entities.
Well, had subpoenas ever been issued to the tribal entities?
No, I understand the court's confusion, and I'm unaware of any other case like this in the annals of Colorado jurisprudence where parties come in unannounced, basically as interveners, although they appeared specially, if there's such a thing in the state of Colorado. And they proceeded to litigate against the state of Colorado for 8 years until everybody automatically assumed that they were parties that had been served and been brought involuntarily into the case by service of process. That was just never the case. So I know that when Judge Hoffman writes in February of 2012 that he's vacating an order, he's assuming that there was an order, even though we tried to disabuse him of this notion, that there was in fact an order requiring these tribal entities first to respond to a subpoena and second to show cause why the refusal to respond to the subpoena wasn't contemptible. So it doesn't make sense when you look at it from afar, but that's the realities of it.
Are you telling us that there were two orders enforcing administrative subpoenas?
There were two orders, Judge Nieto. One against a Nevada corporation called CV Service Corporation and its trade name known as Cash Advance. Another against another Nevada corporation known as Executive Global Management and its trade name Preferred Cash Loans.
Those were pursued at the same time.
Those were the only ones that the state pursued.
Then how does Judge Hoffman's order not vacate those orders?
Because I think he's referring, I think you have to look at the context in which that order comes about. And that order comes about post-remand, a decision whether or not these payday lending enterprises were arms of their respective tribes entitled to immunity. That was the only issue before him. And what the only issue he ruled on in February of 2012 was whether or not those tribal entities retained sovereign immunity from suit to prevent the state either from enforcing a subpoena against them or holding them in contempt. So when he's vacating those orders, he's vacating orders that he assumes exist against those tribal entities. And as a matter of just the passage of time, they might as well have existed. But there, he was not vacating in that order any orders with respect to Executive Global and CB Services Corporation.
But those were, in fact, the only orders to enforce subpoena that existed in the case.
In reality, they were the only orders, but I'm suggesting that as a matter of 8 years' worth of litigation, everybody, certainly the courts, all assumed that the tribal entities were equally defendants in that litigation, subject to an enforcement order, subject to a contempt citation.
Did you file anything with Judge Hoffman asking for clarification of this potential ambiguity in his order?
No, because we didn't view it as a ambiguity at all. I mean, we'd spent the last 11 months litigating the issues on remand before Judge Hoffman. Those issues on remand dealt solely and only with the two tribal entities and not with Executive Global and CB Services Corporation. The Nevada corporations never appealed the initial denial of their motions to dismiss in February of 2007. So for 11 months, we fought over discovery, the scope of discovery with regard to the tribal entities. We fought over issues of the scope and definition of the mandate, which we go through extensively in our pleadings, and ultimately over the significance of the evidence that was produced or otherwise adduced by the state of Colorado with respect solely to the issue of whether or not these tribal entities could extend their sovereign immunity to apply to entities that they neither own nor operate. So when the judge ruled in November of 2012, he wasn't casting this wide net dismissing everybody that was left in the case. He was ruling solely and only with respect to the tribal entities. So, 3 minutes. Let me tell you what I was hoping to try to accomplish, and I think I'll do this in the following fashion. We think that the court, first and foremost, got the mandate wrong when he said the particular business that is being engaged in here is irrelevant. I think it's exactly the opposite. I think whether or not these tribal entities have sovereign immunity is irrelevant under the mandate. What is relevant is whether or not they are able to extend that immunity to payday lending businesses that Judge Hoffman, at least through 2008, found didn't belong to the tribes at all, belonged to Scott Tucker and these Nevada corporations that we all knew about. But I believe, and our brief points out, that his misapplication of that mandate colored and artificially, prejudicially restricted the state's allowable discovery in this case, so that we couldn't examine or follow the money, in the judge's words, the true ownership and operation of these payday lending enterprises, which is what this case has been about since February of 2005. And that as a result of that misapplication of the mandate, he took too narrow a view of the evidence that was introduced in this case, including bank records post-2008 that showed that anybody but the tribes obviously owned and operated these businesses. Scott Tucker was pulling between $30 and $40 million a year out of these businesses, supposedly after he was no longer involved. It was uncontested evidence that he chose to ignore, and I believe it ties directly to his unwillingness to take a look at the mandate in its proper light. And we walked through that, and we can rely on our briefs with respect to to both waiver arguments that we make down below. I know that Mr. Hicks's attorneys are going to take a few minutes of time, so let me address that issue this way for your honors. Obviously, the state takes seriously any sanctions award, and by minimizing the amount of time I spent on this issue before you today, I don't mean to suggest that we don't take that seriously. What's frustrating about that particular order is that no matter how many times we say it, how many times we argue it, the courts don't seem to understand that we never sought contempt against Mr. Hicks. Right? He wasn't served with a contempt citation. We never intended to serve for a contempt citation. The arrest warrant that went out for Mr. Hicks in March of 2007 was as a result of the corporation, CB Services, of which he was the sole officer, director, and president. When that corporation failed to appear to be advised on a contempt citation against it. And the question in this case, and one that's never been addressed by the courts that I'm aware of, is when a corporation is cited for contempt and fails to appear as 107C requires it to do so, to whom does a bench warrant issue in that instance? Or how else do you compel a corporation to respond to a court order to appear and show cause? Judge Hyde, who was the judge back then, understood full well that Mr. Hicks was not an alleged contender. But he understood, and that's what the state requested, not in a pleading, as Judge Hoffman believes, but in oral argument before the court, that the way to compel a non-appearing corporation to appear is a bench warrant issued to its sole officer and director, who, by the way, and I realize I'm slightly over my time.
Well, go ahead. We interrupted you with the jurisdictional.
No worries. Who, by the way, had notice, despite their arguments to the contrary, of these proceedings. It was his corporation's counsel that identified him to us in the first place. It was his corporation's counsel, when they withdrew from the case, who represented to the state and to the court that they had met with and advised their client as they're required to do by Rule 121. When a corporation has a single officer and director, you've got to assume that means Mr. Hicks. And they provided an address that we could send notice to the corporation and to Mr. Hicks of further proceedings in this case. In advance of the advisement hearing, the state mailed a notice both to CB Services Corporation and to Mr. Hicks at the address that his lawyer provided to us for that purpose. And we advised in that notice, and it's in the record, we advised in that notice that if the corporation fails to appear, a bench warrant for their non-appearance could issue to the appropriate officer or director. So notice was present, there was no misrepresentation to the court about the status, and no basis, no written pleading signed by counsel, no basis for the issuance of sanctions in this case. So I appreciate the additional time you awarded me.
And counsel, you said that one of your colleagues wanted 2 minutes. You can take the full 15 and we'll add 2 minutes on for your co-counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Excuse me. Conley Schulte on behalf of what's been commonly called the tribal entities in these proceedings, which are SFS Incorporated, a subdivision of the Santee Sioux Nation, and Miami Nation Enterprises, a subdivision of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma. And with me today at counsel table is Ed Lyons with the law firm of Jones and Keller. I'd like to first address...
Counsel, before you begin, let me ask you a question. Your clients were never joined as parties to this suit. Is that correct?
Your Honor, no, that is not correct. We appeared and specially moved to dismiss on jurisdictional grounds in this matter.
And if you're not a party to it, how did you get involved? That's my question. If you were never named as a party, if you were never served, if you were never sanctioned, sought against you, how'd you get in the case?
Well, Your Honor, the problem started when the state, in its initial subpoenas, named trade names, not actual entities. It named simply fictitious trade names. And our clients became aware of those subpoenas, and when we became aware of it, made a special appearance because my clients were actually doing business using those trade names at that time.
Were there two companies operating with the same trade names?
It appears that there were, perhaps at different points in time, but the trade names were being used, is pretty clear by the Nevada corporations as well as the tribal entities at different points in time. But I would like to address the motion to dismiss because it is jurisdictional and it is dispositive of this appeal. Now, the order that the state is truly appealing from here is Judge Hoffman's February 18th order. All of the issues it brings in this appeal relate to that order. And that order is a final appealable judgment because Judge Hoffman expressly vacated the underlying orders enforcing the subpoenas in this February 18th order. This court's ruling in the Duhon case holds that an order enforcing subpoenas is a final appealable judgment. Under Rule 4, the state's appeal deadline ran from that order on April 30th, 2012. the state didn't file its notice of appeal in this case for a full 67 days after that deadline expired. Thus, this appeal is untimely and it must be dismissed. Now, the state claims that the appeal clock didn't begin to run until it procured an unopposed order vacating some collateral contempt proceedings against Nevada corporations that hadn't appeared in 6 years in this case, simply must fail. Under Duhon, the underlying order enforcing the subpoenas is the final appealable judgment, and Judge Hoffman's order vacating that is the final appealable judgment here. When you combine that with the Supreme Court's ruling in Kavanaugh, which holds that contempt proceedings are collateral proceedings, an appeal from which cannot be used to attack an underlying final judgment from which a timely appeal is not taken, the only result that you can get here is that this appeal is untimely and it must be dismissed.
Is it untimely for all purposes? And I'm thinking particularly of the state's desire to appeal the sanctions.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I'll let Mr. Hicks address that issue.
Okay, that's fair. Go ahead.
Mr. Hicks' counsel, but certainly for purposes of the tribal entities appeal, it certainly is out of time, and the court has no jurisdiction over it under the broader case cited in our briefs. So what the state really wants to do here, if you could take its argument to its logical conclusion, is effectively get a rule that would say that as long as the state has outstanding collateral contempt proceedings pending against any party to a case, the appeal deadline is full for all parties to the case. Carried out to the logical conclusion, then, had the state not procured the unopposed order vacating the collateral contempt proceedings against the Nevada corporations, its appeal deadline would not have run to this day. Almost 2 years later, under the state's theory, it could still file a notice of appeal. That is a blatant attempt to do an end around the clear provisions of Rule 4, and it should not be allowed. There's also other black letter law pronounced in the Bigler, Deason, and Horton cases cited in our brief that says a party cannot procure an order of the court and then appeal from it. But that's exactly what the state is attempting to do here. It procured an unopposed order vacating collateral contempt proceedings against Nevada entities that hadn't appeared in 6 years, and then claims to have appealed from it. But it speaks volumes that not one issue raised by the state in this appeal has anything to do with that May 23rd order vacating the contempt proceedings.
Clearly, counsel, I don't understand that argument. They're not alleging there's any error in granting their motion to dismiss those parties. Is that what you're saying, that you think they're appealing from that order?
They claim that their appeal is from that order.
Well, I understood their argument to be that simply the judgment wasn't final until they were dismissed, not that they were appealing the order dismissing.
Well, their claim is that order triggers the clock to start their appeal deadline.
But that's not the same thing as appealing that order, is it?
Well, substantively, they're not appealing anything of substance from that order. They are substantively appealing for Judge Hoffman's order, and that order and the appeal deadline ran on April 30th.
Had the circumstances been different, and had these been active players participating in the case, and there were still claims against them of some viable sort, then this would not have been a final order. Isn't that true?
That's true, but that wasn't the case, because the order enforcing the subpoenas was the final judgment in this matter, and Judge Hoffman's order vacating that was also a final judgment.
But I'd simply make that point to illustrate that they're not, I don't see them as appealing those orders they requested dismissing these two corporations. Their appeal doesn't go to that. Their argument is simply as to finality.
My co-counsel has handed me their reply brief at page 1, where in the state states this appeal is from the dismissal of the later contempt proceedings, referencing the May 23rd, 2012 order. So that is the admission by the state on that point. Although substantively they raised no issue based upon that order. So just to sum up, this appeal clearly was not timely brought. It is jurisdictional, and therefore it must be dismissed. I'd like to then briefly address some of the other arguments brought by Mr. Zavisson. Chiefly, the argument that the district court misapplied the mandate in this case. Now, the Supreme Court's mandate for the remand proceedings was very narrow. It required the district court to apply the arm of the tribe test to my clients, SFS and MNE. There were no other parties before the Supreme Court. There were no other parties before Judge Hoffman on remand. There are no other appellees here today other than Mr. Hicks, who is not part of the arm of the tribe test, obviously. And in applying that arm of the tribe test, the Supreme Court expressly stated 3 separate times in the opinion that the district court was to, quote, focus on the relationship between the tribal entities and the tribes. The court then expressly defined the tribal entities in its opinion, saying, quote, this opinion refers to MNE and SFS collectively as the tribal entities, close quote. That conclusively lays to rest the state's argument that Judge Hoffman incorrectly applied the mandate by examining the relationship between the tribal entities and the tribes instead of the relationship between the tribes and some fictitious trade names or some amorphous business which is undefined. The arm of the tribe test cannot be applied to a fictitious trade name. It cannot be applied to an amorphous business. It has to be applied to an entity. And throughout the Supreme Court's opinion, it spoke of applying the test to entities. The only entities before the court were my clients, SFS and MNE. And the only entities from whom the state was seeking to enforce its subpoena and seeking to produce documents to the state were SFS and MNE. Accordingly, Judge Hoffman clearly applied the mandate in accordance with the Supreme Court's opinion. Again, I submit that the state is simply wrong on that point.
Wouldn't the activities of these subordinate organizations from the tribe be relevant in determining whether or not they are, in fact, an arm of the court, an arm of the tribe? It seems to me what you're suggesting is that the court should only have looked at the relationship between these subordinate entities and the tribe itself without ever looking at what those subordinate entities were engaged in. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying, and that's exactly what the Supreme Court said in the Kiowa case, United States Supreme Court, and that's exactly what the Colorado Supreme Court said in its opinion in this case. The purposes of a tribal business are simply irrelevant to the arm of the tribe test. In fact, with due respect to Judge Bernard, is a very well-researched and thoughtful opinion in Cash Advance 1, some of those factors that were originally in the 11-part test from this court were disregarded by the Supreme Court and taken out of that test, and some of those factors dealt with the purpose of the entity. So clearly the Supreme Court examined that issue and held that no, the purpose of the business and the type of business that it's engaged in are not relevant. And there's good reason for that. I mean, as the Supreme Court, both the United States Supreme Court and the Colorado Supreme Court recognized, the only entity with the ability to diminish tribal sovereign immunity is the United States Congress. States do not have the authority to draw a line saying, well, for purposes of this business tribe, you enjoy sovereign immunity in our courts, but for purposes of this business, you do not. That is not within the state's power, because once you give the state that power, it gives the state the power to diminish tribal sovereign immunity, a power that has been expressly withheld from it by the United States Constitution and the decisions of the United States Supreme Court.
So the only issue below on remand, in your perspective, was the relationship between what we're calling the tribal entities and the tribes themselves.
That's what the Supreme Court said 3 times in its opinion. In applying the arm of the tribe test, the district court was to focus on the relationship between the tribal entities and the tribes.
Thank you.
I'd like to briefly, since I have a little bit of time left, discuss the waiver arguments that the state made in its briefs. Principally, the so-called sue and be sued clauses in the tribe's federal charters. That is a red herring. Yes, each of these tribes, the Santee Sioux Nation and the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma, have federal charters issued from the government. But there is no evidence in the record whatsoever that these tribes have ever done business using those charters. Those Section 17 charters are a separate corporation from the tribal government. SFS and MNE do not have a federal charter. They have a tribal charter that was issued by the Santee Sioux Nation and the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma, respectively, pursuant to their constitutional powers in the very same constitution that was issued to these tribes at the same time that the federal charter was issued back in the 1930s. For example, SFS was chartered under tribal law pursuant to the tribal council's constitutional authority to, quote, charter subordinate organizations for economic purposes. That's a direct quote from the Santee Sioux Constitution that was approved by the Secretary of the Interior at Article 4, Section 1, Subparagraph K. SFS's Articles of Incorporation restricted from waiving sovereign immunity without an express resolution of the tribal council, the governing body of the tribe, and none exists. Likewise, the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma has a tribal constitution that authorizes it to charter subordinate organizations for economic purposes, and that's exactly what it did in creating MNE through the MNE Act, which is a tribal law enacted by the tribe creating that entity. Likewise, MNE's charter does not permit MNE to waive its sovereign immunity without an express resolution of the business committee of the tribe, its governing body. So this whole argument about a sue and be sued clause in a Section 7 corporation is nothing but a red herring, because the Section 17 corporations are not before this court. And even if they were before this court, the sue and be sued language is not a clear and unequivocal waiver of tribal sovereign immunity from the state's investigative subpoena action. And that's what the Supreme Court directed the district court to examine. At best, it's an implied waiver of sovereign immunity. Every decision relied upon by the state either predates the Supreme Court's decision in the Santa Clara Pueblo case or relies upon authority that predates it. The Supreme Court in the Santa Clara Pueblo case and its progeny, ending most recently with the Cairo case, expressly says, and a waiver of sovereign immunity cannot be implied, but must be clearly and unequivocally expressed. And the power to sue and be sued is permissive. At best, it is an implied waiver of sovereign immunity, and Judge Hoffman recognized that in his decision on remand. Lastly, I just have a few seconds, but with regard to the claim that Judge Hoffman denied the state discovery, denied the ability to take depositions, if you examine the record, Judge Hoffman never once entered any order prohibiting the state from taking any depositions. The state knew it had a limited period of time from March 1st to November 22nd, which was the hearing date, to conduct discovery in this matter. It had every opportunity to depose any witness it wanted to up to the date of that hearing, including almost a month after it had the affidavits from the affiants from whom they said they did not have the opportunity to cross-examine. They also had the opportunity to take live testimony, but chose not to. The state chose not to bring live testimony at the evidentiary hearing before Judge Hoffman, so it is not an abuse of discretion for Judge Hoffman to have denied discovery. It's just the state's lack of diligence that they didn't do it.
Okay, I think your time's exhausted. If the clerk could put 3 minutes back on the clock for Mr. Hicks.
Thank you.
May I please the clerk? My name is Jim Neslin with Jeff Smith. We're representing Michael Hicks. And the court should know that we also represented Mr. Hicks in the trial court. And I asked for a few minutes because I really have 2 points that I want to make. The first is, this court should affirm Judge Hoffman's award of attorney's fees to Mr. Hicks, both against the Attorney General and against Mr. Chester. And the second point I want to make is this court should award, and I'll put it for the same reasons, attorney's fees to Mr. Hicks against the Attorney General for defending against what I think is a frivolous and groundless appeal. Let me give you the reasons why I believe the court should affirm the sanctions. And that's because what Mr. Chesham and the Attorney General did to Mr. Hicks was outrageous, was unprecedented, and was groundless
and frivolous.
There was absolutely no factual basis, absolutely no legal basis for arresting and incarcerating him without first serving him personally with the contempt citation, the motion, the affidavit, and the order to show cause.
So how do you respond to the argument that it's only through its officers that the orders against the corporation can be enforced? And if he's the operating officer of the corporation, why is not notice to the corporation notice to him?
Because Rule 107(c)(3) makes it clear, if you're going to arrest a person, that person has to be served with those papers. And as Judge Hoffman said, there's a difference between holding the corporation in contempt and holding an individual responsible for the corporate contempt. And there's a lot of law on that. And what happened here was, first of all, that's factually incorrect. From day one, they sought this contempt citation, the orders, the application for the order of enforcement. Who did it run against? Who did Mr. Chesham draft it and prepare it to run against? The corporation, the officers, the directors, the shareholders, and the employees. That's who we applied to get the order of enforcement against, not just the corporation. All right. When there wasn't compliance, who did he ask to have a contempt citation issued against? The corporation, the officers, the directors, the employees, and the shareholders. At every stage, Mr. Chesham was chasing the corporation and those for whom they were responsible. So that is what happened, and that is what Judge Hoffman said when he said, that's just not true. And he cited all of those where he showed that at every stage of this litigation, every stage of these proceedings, he sought it against the corporation and against the individual. But on a second basis, he also said, it doesn't make any difference. It's beside the point. Because if you are after Mr. Hicks for the corporate contempt, and that's the person you wanted to arrest, under Rule 107C, you still have to serve him. That's what the rule says. He says not only does the rule say that, but he says fundamental due process says you just can't walk out and bushwhack someone.
I think your time is, on that note, sir, I think your time is exhausted. Right. We appreciate the arguments and counsel. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course.